You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks, she had a pet snake, she bought a red guitar. This episode is brought to you by our patrons, Kathy Ferguson, Professor of Political Theory in Star Trek, and Ari Ashkenazi.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Mythgreens Podcast. I'm Oren, and with me today is...
Chris.
And...
Wes.
And folks, I have often said very critical things about stories on Mythgreens. Some people didn't like that and have even labeled me a villain, but I think I can be redeemed. So today we're talking about how to redeem evil characters, and if you should do it or why you should do it. So guys, how am I going to be redeemed?
Wait.
Like, what is my arc?
Well, if what made you a villain is being critical, are you going to be spending this podcast, like, praising a whole bunch of stories?
Yeah, absolutely. Regardless of their merit, I will say that they're great stories. It will be a completely believable transformation, and everyone will love me afterwards.
I feel like there hasn't been enough foreshadowing for this. I feel like this is just, like, out of the blue. It's like Deus Ex Machina, maybe.
Well, still, Oren, if you're going to be redeemed, we need to figure out what the heck that actually means. Because, like, you know, Magneto helps out the X-Men every now and then. Does that mean he's not a villain? Does that mean he's now on team good?
What even is good?
Yes.
Is the universe a moral place? I mean, okay, so, like, I think there's a pretty clear distinction between someone like Magneto, who is a villain, but he's a villain with goals that intersect with the X-Men's goals sometimes, mm-hmm. right? Because Magneto's goals are, while they are often bad, are not, like, we want to blow up the planet kind of bad. So when a villain who wants to blow up the planet shows up, as happens sometimes in X-Men, Magneto and the X-Men will team up to fight them to stop the world from being blown up.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be an actual redemption story for Magneto buried somewhere in Marvel's back issues. I don't know. As opposed to, like, a story where there is a clear, like, change of sides and a changing of, like, objectives. And now this person is on the opposite from where they started, and that would be something like Spike from Buffy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, there's no question that Spike is now a good guy. He's on team good. He is not fighting for the bad guys anymore. He's not, like, temporarily allying with Buffy, although he also did that earlier in the show.
Yeah. I think it's worth specifying the difference between, like, the protagonist and, like, what is sometimes called, like, the shapeshifter archetype, which is actually a hero's journey archetype, where the shapeshifter is a character where you're not quite sure if they're a protagonist or a villain. Like, it's usually they are partnering with Team Good, but you can't really trust them. I think probably the best example, and a villain can turn into a shapeshifter either permanently, or Spike, I think, turns into a shapeshifter before becoming a full-fledged protagonist. A really good example is actually Peter from Teen Wolf. Peter, you know, is a big bad in the first season. And then after that, he kind of, like, loses his powers and, you know, becomes kind of a team member with the protagonist. But they always know that he has, like, selfish motivations.
Mm-hmm.
And that they can never really trust him, you know? And so there are some situations in which maybe it's not believable to make this villain into full-fledged protagonist, but you can keep them around and also use them to create a little extra conflict if they're a shapeshifter instead of a villain, right?
Can I take a moment to talk about what I think is, like, my favorite villain to hero redemption story?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, okay, so this is Damar from Deep Space Nine.
Mm.
Because, like, when Damar first shows up, he's, like, Cardassian Helmsman number 3, right? Like, I didn't even know he had a name
mm-hmm.
when he first showed up. He's, like, just one of Dukat's guys. And, like, over the course of the series, he, like, kind of becomes Dukat's like second and his advisor, and he's like, for a while, he's actually the one egging Dukat on. Like, Dukat is kind of being like, no, let's show mercy and be magnanimous, and Dumar's like, no man, that's like your pride talking. We need to be ruthless and like do the pragmatic thing. And then like he shoots Zial because like he found Zial's Dukat's daughter, and like because like you know, because she's a traitor. And then like over the course of the next season, he like becomes slowly disillusioned with the Dominion that he's allied with, who are like the big bads. And then like you know, by the time he turned, I was like really hoping it was gonna happen, and that when it did, it was like, oh, it feels so good. It's like the such a good culmination of his journey, right?
Yeah, I feel like with a lot of these arcs, it's almost the longer it takes for them to be redeemed, the more satisfying it is. And because with any kind of character change, rushing it creates so many problems.
Yeah.
And it's almost like the longer you take, the usually the more believable it is, the more satisfying it is. The other, you know, I think really strong examples I can think of also take a significant period of time. Like Spike, mm-hmm. you know, not every decision they made about Spike was a good decision. I'll just say that.
Right.
there's some obvious ones, but they really did take their time with it. And it took a number of seasons for him to get from full-fledged villain to, like, undisputably a protagonist. And that, I think, allowed them to really go in-depth and make it very believable.
Yeah, and I mean, looking at others that are on my list of good ones, like, it's all going to be proportional to what the story they're using is, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you know, Nux from Fury Road, who is the war boy who turns to Team Good, like... That transformation takes about a good quarter of the movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's still a movie, so it's only 2 hours, but it's a big chunk of time within that context.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true. And it also makes a difference, of course, how evil they are and how far they have to move, because Nux is never, like, a super evil character, right?
Yes.
Like, he's not a good, but it's clear in the beginning that he's kind of an ignorant tool. Mm-hmm. More than he is malicious. And that allows them to, I think, change him faster than if he was, like, a really big bad, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, this can sometimes feel a little bit cheap, but I've noticed that it is often a good idea for the redeemed villain to die before the story is over, just because otherwise you end up in a weird situation where it's like, okay, the villain changed sides, but, like, he still did a bunch of bad things.
Right.
And like him, the villain dying, like it avoids us having to address that. Right. Like, you know, you don't have to go put Darth Vader on trial for war crimes because he blew up Alderaan, even though, because he's dead now. Right. Like we just got to have him like turn and help Luke and then die. So he doesn't like, whether if he'd like escaped with Luke, it would have been like, okay, Luke, yeah, you brought back, like, the most wanted war criminal in the galaxy, and now you're saying he's a nice guy? no, it's not gonna work.
Yeah, Buffy's approach to that was kind of interesting, because, again, Buffy has this entire ambiguity about whether or not vampires are like people. But certainly the stance that Buffy takes on that is that, like, basically vampires that do not have souls almost don't have free will. And so, like, you can't, once Spike gets his soul back, it's not actually fair to hold him responsible for what he did without his soul.
Right, and they establish that with Angel, right? Where it's, like, pretty clear that Angelus is not the same person as Angel.
But we haven't talked about why we would do this yet, and I think while we're talking about, you know, Spike, I think it's one of the primary reasons that Spike is a really great example for is that if you have a villain that the audience really likes, that's really popular, villains over time, they're just going to lose their threat factor. And so if you want to keep a popular villain, at some point in time, they have to transition to a different role because they just can't be the big bad anymore because they're going to lose their threat. Especially if you've, you know, like if your audience likes them, so you've spent a lot of time with them and demystified them and gotten to know them. At that point, it just makes more sense to just convert them into a protagonist, and that's exactly what happened with Spike.
It also kind of coincides with the world opening up a lot, you know, like in the first, like, you think of like The Last Airbender with Zuko being like the primary antagonist until they kind of like, you learn more about like what's actually motivating Zuko and that there's like a bigger bad behind him. And, you know, yeah, I think that's kind of an interesting bit that, yeah, you can't sustain it for that long as like you learn more about the story and what's motivating the villains or, yeah. Interesting.
So Zuko is a little different because Zuko is also an excellent example of a villain turning and protagonist, very well developed. I've ranted about him before at length. But the thing about him is he was definitely a planned conversion as opposed to Spike, who was introduced just to be a villain and then just got popular. Zuko was clearly planned from the beginning that he would be a protagonist. And so they kept him from doing too much evil.
Yeah.
He never really, like, he would steal things, and he probably gave people some burn scars at some point, but like he didn't really kill people in cold blood or
he didn't,
you know,
try to kill the moon or like
right, he didn't do anything unforgivable.
He didn't cross the moral event horizon, as it would be called.
Right, and there are some characters that do that, and once they do, it's kind of hard to get them back. For example, Teen Wolf comes to mind. Like, I like Teen Wolf a lot, but the spoilers for Teen Wolf, if you haven't seen it already, it's all on Amazon, go watch it. But the at the end of season 3 part 1, they have the Alpha Pack, and the leader of the Alpha Pack, who they just kind of, they're like, okay, I guess we're not gonna fight you anymore, and like, you've changed your ways. They have like a little talk with him at the end, and it's like, okay, first of all, there's not really any indication that he's changed his ways. But even if he had, like, he's done really awful things, right? Like, he has killed a lot of innocent people. And it's like, that just feels very unsatisfying. It's like, okay, he just gets to walk away. I get that you guys don't like killing people and you don't have werewolf jail, but that's not satisfying, right? Like, when a villain does that many bad things, and at the end he's just like, well, I guess I'm a good guy now. It's like, no, bro. You don't get to just say you're a good guy now and we forget all everything you did.
Yeah. A common pitfall, and it happens also with villains who aren't changed into protagonists just at the end, is just dismissing what the person has done and the likelihood they'll do it again. Because it's like the writer knows that they're not going to make this character do any more villainous things, but it's still weird if all the protagonists are like, it's fine, this person's not a threat. Like, you know, reading the book, Queen of the Tyrling right now, and there's just this regent that when she takes the throne, it's her uncle, tries to kill her. But, like, then they portray him as very pathetic, and she just lets him live. But it's really weird because the characters shouldn't know that he wouldn't be dangerous. Even if the writer has decided this character is not dangerous, the characters have no actual real concrete reason to think that he's not going to be threatening. And just letting a character go again is just, I've seen it a lot recently.
And it should be pointed out that in that book, when he tried to kill her, he almost succeeded. It wasn't like an incompetent attempt. It almost worked. That terrible book aside.
Maybe we should talk about Bellamy.
Do we have to?
Tell you what, if you don't want to talk about Bellamy,
I want to talk about Bellamy.
I see. See, this is the wavering part of the villain's journey, when like the villain is deciding, you know, whether to be good, and then falls back on old criticism habits.
Chris and I are gonna have to fight about Bellamy for a minute. I don't like Bellamy. I think that he's a jerk, and I don't find his character particularly compelling. And I found it even less compelling when they were like, "It's time for flashbacks. Bellamy had a hard life." It's like, yeah, whatever. We all had hard lives, Bellamy. That's not an excuse. And I stopped watching before the end of season 1, so like, it's certainly possible that more stuff happened to make his you know, redemption work better. But for me, he was still a dick. I still like wanted something bad to happen to him, especially since like so many much better people had died on this planet. It just it was just wrong to me that he got to live, you know?
Well, you know, here's what I will say, and I think this is one of the things that probably pissed you off, is that there just seems to be a pattern in some stories where they rely on a character, they rely either on making the character more likable or having the character just feeling bad to try to redeem them instead of actually taking action. And
yes.
So what happens with Bellamy's arc is that when they decide that it's time for him to, in season one, and we're talking about Bellamy from the 100, specifically the 100 TV show. In season one, when they decide that they want to start taking him down a redemption arc, the first step they take is to do an episode that brings up his backstory, not because that redeems him, but because they want to make him more likable so that the audience wants him to be redeemed. And since Oren hated him so much, this is the point at which Oren rage quit.
This is why I stopped watching the show, because I was like, oh no, they're trying to redeem Bellamy.
But that wasn't actually the redemption. That was like the preparation for the redemption. You know, like first let's get the audience to sympathize with the character. That in itself, and there are some stories that make the mistake of just leaving it there as though that redeems the character, and it doesn't. The character still has to make up for the bad things they did. But after they do that backstory episode to try to like make him more likable, then they go through a series of other episodes where he, you know, owns up to his mistake, you know, feels bad about it, and then makes choices to try to make up for his mistakes and be a better person. Which is how it has to end. Like, it's not enough for them to feel bad. And I think this is the problem with, I actually think they try to do it again later, and I think they don't do it as well. So in season three, Bellamy kind of goes bad again for different reasons, really. And then towards the end of season three and in season four, you know, they work to try to, you know, give him more like redemption, but it doesn't quite work. And the reason it doesn't work is that their emphasis is on how he feels bad and not about what he's doing to make up for it. They do in season four have him take actions. Basically, he kills a bunch of people who, following a bad leader, he perceived as enemies but were actually allies. That's in the 100, there's so much violence that is actually not as bad as it sounds, believe it or not. But it's still pretty bad. He killed a lot of people. And he feels bad, but then he takes a savior role for his own people, like risking himself unduly to save his own people, rather than actually doing something to make it up to the tribe whose people he actually killed. And they emphasize how bad he feels, but like feeling bad isn't enough. You need to see that the character is doing something to make up for it, whatever it is, and some sign that they, you know, at least feeling bad gives you some sign they won't just do it again, so that's something. But they have to do something. They have to actually take actions to make up for what they did.
Or I guess they could just like inexplicably switch sides and nobody could mention it again. Thinking of Sorsha and Willow is my favorite example of that. Where it's like, oh man, I guess you're really hot, Mad Mardigan. I guess I'm on your side now.
Yeah, well, Val Kilmer, come on.
Still really confused that Mad Mardigan is his name. I thought his name was Mardigan and Mad was a title or like an honorific that people called him. But no, his full name is Mad Mardigan, no space. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah, I will say for the Sorsha, on the plus side, they at least foreshadow it. It's still way too sudden, but like, you know, her mother is the leader and she has some conflicts with her mother, right? So they do, it's I think the biggest problem with Sorsha is, you know, not the fact that she chooses to change sides, but that when she does so, there's no nothing lingering. Like, they have some foreshadowing, and then she changes sides, but then there's never any, like, awkwardness in dealing with the other protagonists, or, you know, hesitation or regrets, maybe, or, you know, it's just very, it's very like she'd been a protagonist all along.
Yeah.
So, if we're trying to qualify, I'm trying to think about this, like, what really qualifies as, like, a good redemption, and listening to you talk about Bellamy, and then thinking about, like, Sorsha, and, like, yeah, feeling bad is not enough. You have to do something. But I'm wondering, like, if you have to really be redeemed, it seems like that needs to actually involve, like, meaningful sacrifice, which, like, you know, we talked about Darth Vader, like, kills him, like sacrifices himself basically mm-hmm. for Luke. Mm-hmm. Sorsha doesn't sacrifice anything, right? Like mm-hmm. she's just like Mad Mardigan, all right, and Mom, I hate you now, right? Like yeah. there needs to be meaningful sacrifice, which is probably why, like, if evil characters like do redeem, like they tend to maybe die, because like they can have redemption with their death because they did so many like awful things, or they sacrifice like maybe like their powers, or I don't know, there has to be something really meaty there for it to be believable.
Yeah, I think it depends on whether the villain has actually crossed that moral event horizon. So for instance, Sorsha, I don't think she actually has. Like, she's not very nice, but we haven't actually seen her like murder children or anything. We know she's leaving. She leads one of the bad guys' armies. But we don't actually see the damage she does. And so I don't feel like it feels like she's crossed the moral event horizon. So, and same with Zuko. Zuko certainly hasn't crossed the moral event horizon. And so I think in those cases, probably the sacrifice is a little less necessary. But when we know that somebody, like, you know, has destroyed Alderaan.
I mean, and Sorsha's kind of tricky because Sorsha is like, there's the question of what have we seen her do versus what can we infer that she's done.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's... that's like that's an issue with like world building, right? Is like you built this world where there's a evil witch who has armies that oppress the land, and it's like, yeah, but like we never actually saw you oppressing anybody, so just is probably fine.
But let's not forget that she seemed pretty okay with basically being commanded by her mom to go find and kill this baby, right? Like, I mean, that's what like they were all doing, was to find this baby and, you know, mm-hmm. bring it to the queen so that this baby could get killed. So I mean, like, she's like clearly didn't seem to have any issues with those orders in the first place.
And it's notable that like what makes her change her mind is not realizing that she can't kill a baby. Right? Still perfectly okay with killing a baby, but like there's a hot dude on the baby side.
So Mad Mardigan.
I'm gonna be over there, you know? That's my jam now. But like, I mean, I think that in some ways, another good reason to redeem a villain can actually be as a way to show that the main villain, because in this case, this it's a side villain that you're redeeming.
Yeah.
That you can show the main villain has kind of gone off the road and is like completely beyond the pale now, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though Star Trek Insurrection is a bad movie, one of the things that they do well is they have the main villain, whose name I cannot be bothered to remember, has like a lieutenant whose name is Gallatin, and God, it was hard to find that guy's name. For some reason, it's just not listed anywhere, even though he's a pretty major character in the story. We see him, like, kind of have some reservations about what they're doing, but he's mostly okay with it until the leader is like, all right, now instead of taking all of the people off the planet that we want, we're just gonna kill all of them.
Mm.
And he's like, okay, that's too much. I didn't sign up for this. And, like, I think that's a reasonable redemption arc for him, because he hasn't crossed the event horizon, and he's specifically drawing the line because he was told to do something he wasn't willing to do, right? As opposed to finding out that what he'd already done was wrong, mm-hmm. which is I think the more standard way of redeeming a villain.
Yeah. Something I see a lot is having a villain that will be redeemed, where to start the foreshadowing, they are compelled to do terrible things like that, and even though they're uncomfortable with it, they do it anyway. And that way you know that they're having doubts, but then doing the thing that they really don't like gives them motivation to become better. Seems to be, like, I've seen that around, it seems to be a fairly, like, good way to foreshadow their change coming, is by having them have doubts and make the wrong choice. And then, I mean, and it's a little bit like with Zuko, what Zuko does when he has a choice, an earlier choice, I think it's in season 2, whether to join the good guys or join with his family. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's at the end of season 2.
Yeah, and you see that he has a lot of doubts, already has a lot of doubts about his family, but then just chooses to join with them anyway and then regrets it later.
Right, and that's like a fair, that one is very clever, because that's a, that's like an audience fake out, because okay, so we see that Zuko have doubts, but then he like doubles down on his evil family at what we thought was Zuko's resurrection arc.
Mm-hmm.
And that is like, oh, well, now the audience thinks Zuko's not going to be redeemed. That, and so then when he actually does get redeemed, it's like, wow, that was a surprise. Like, I did not see that coming.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least you don't see it coming until a few episodes before it happens, but same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So we end up talking about Harry Potter a lot. What's the deal with Malfoy? How does he play into this? Because
I have no idea. I'm so confused what's going on with Malfoy.
Right? I think about, like, his like henchmen goon friends, like they just like by the end of that story, they're just basically throwing like death curses around like candy. Like they seem to have like no regard for human life and just doing whatever. But like, does Malfoy have like a redeeming moment, or does he just kind of
he has a redeeming moment. Okay, so, and I'll tell you when it is. It's when they're in the Room of Requirement, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one, so I forget which of his henchmen, because they're pretty interchangeable. I forget if it's Crabbe or Goyle. One of them has gained the ability to cast Demon Fire,
It's
called. Mm. And I was like, whoa, where did you learn to do that? Okay. That one gets burned up, but the other one is still alive, and Malfoy, who's being rescued by Harry, because of course Harry rescues Malfoy, is like, we have to go back for henchman number two. I think it's Goyle. I think Goyle is the one that's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so Malfoy risks his own life to save Goyle, even though at that point, up until then, as far as we know, those were just like, you know, disposable henchmen for him who basically did what he said because he was of higher status than them.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Malfoy's redeeming moment.
Right.
Yeah. Malfoy is definitely an interesting character because even though he is a villain, I think you get the distinct sense, at least in the later books, if not the earlier ones, that he is a villain because of the social pressure placed on him that he is trying to live up to. Like, it's not that he's just not a person who feels able to go against those who are closest to him, and so he's been pressed into that role and would not have actually chosen it, he's just not strong enough to resist it. And that kind of becomes increasingly evident when he decides that he cannot bring himself to kill Dumbledore, even though he finds the perfect moment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody expects him to be able to come up with a plan to kill Dumbledore, but he actually succeeds at that pretty well, but then can't kill Dumbledore. And so that definitely sets him up well, but I do feel like that's a good redeeming moment. I feel like it would have been nice to see him do something like save Harry's life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I think that would have been better.
Mm-hmm. Like, Malfoy was... That's part of the reason I was confused about Malfoy, is that, like... It's like, part of the reason I think his arc is kind of unsatisfying, at least to me, is that, yes, he has his redeeming moment, and he's, like, sort of not a villain anymore, but he's, like... He didn't really change that much. Like, he did something I didn't know he was capable of before, but it was, like, he's still clearly a wizard Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
He's just not as much of one as Voldemort is.
Right.
And in fact, that's the whole problem with the Malfoys in general, is, like, people talk about how, like, well, Malfoy's mom turning against Voldemort is like a sign that she's switching sides, and it's like, not really. She just doesn't want him to kill her son. Like,
right.
Like, yeah. Voldemort decided to kill their son, and she was like, okay, I'm not down with that. It's like she has personal beef with Voldemort. She didn't actually change any of her beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so that's part of what was confusing me about Malfoy, was that, like, it seemed weird that it's like the book kind of treats him like he's redeemed after that, and they go into that more in the Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, if you feel like reading a play script.
Yeah,
they go into that a little bit more, but it struck me as weird at the end that, like, Malfoy's there in the epilogue with all of them, with his kids who are going to Hogwarts, and I was like, is there I feel like maybe that wasn't earned. Yeah. You know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, hey, remember that time when I joined the wizard Nazis? It's like, yeah, I remember that was uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think the problem with the Malfoys is that sometimes when you have a villain that people like, they feel like their villainhood itself is almost part of their cool factors, cool factor. Mm-hmm. And this is true with Spike, but I think they handled it much better with Spike. Where it's like, I think there might be a reluctance to bring them all the way on the side of not Nazi factor, not Nazi, because being evil
yeah.
is like part of what supposedly makes the Malfoys cool. Where with Spike, I think that was also true. The fact that Spike was kind of like dark and aggressive was also supposed to be part of why people liked him, but they made it so that he's a person who is not afraid to get his hands dirty as a protagonist. And they mm-hmm. also spend some time away from that. When he first becomes a protagonist, he's a lot less aggressive and a lot more humble. And then he has to be nudged back into being more aggressive because they have to fight bad guys.
Although with Spike, I would say with Spike, they had an easier time because the thing that makes Spike cool, in my opinion, if I had to pick one thing that makes people like him, it's his snarky dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to keep that when he became a good guy. That didn't, like, depend on his villainness.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that was the most important part of him.
That was certainly part of it. I think that's also why they, for him, emphasized the fact that, like, him not being regretful about what he did as a vampire because he wasn't the same person. Because mm-hmm. then they could kind of keep... He was always... You know, being tortured was definitely a new thing for him.
Yeah.
So it was always kind of a very kind of like, not cold exactly, just because he had fun, but kind of like an uncaring, insensitive villain. And so, like, making it so that he was not actually responsible for being a vampire allowed him to keep some of that same kind of behavior as a hero. But yeah, it's true that the Malfoys don't really have that kind of character that translates over, and I think part of the problem is it would be hard to figure out. Maybe if Malfoy was a stronger character that had more interesting traits just outside of being an ass.
Yeah.
It would have been easier to bring him over to Team Good completely without making it feel like he just wasn't Malfoy anymore.
All right. Well, on that note, we are out of time, so I will bring this episode of the Mythicreans podcast to a close. Thank you both for joining me to talk about redeeming evil characters. Those of you at home, if anything that we said piqued your interest, you can email us at podcast@mythcreants.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon could.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Colton.